Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
You may have heard last week our discussion about the West Australian government's move to deregister sacred sites, especially the Pilbara area on the north coast, which is both rich with resources and with some of the country's oldest and most precious rock art. This is all coming at a time when remote Aboriginal communities in Western Australia are also under threat. Last year, the West Australian Premier, Colin Barnett, announced that his government plans to withdraw government funding from as many as 150 of the state's 274 remote Aboriginal communities, not the first time the Indigenous people of Western Australia have been moved around. The Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who once declared himself the Prime Minister for Indigenous Affairs, said taxpayers could not be expected to keep funding what he termed as the lifestyle choices of Aboriginal people, a choice to live on the land in remote communities. Well, that comment has angered a lot of people, including Bishop Christopher Saunders, the Catholic Bishop of Broome. He says the attitude is symptomatic of the utter disregard governments have for the feelings and opinions of Indigenous people, and that we Australians need to be convinced of the worth of Indigenous self-determination. Bishop Saunders joins us from our ABC studios in Broome. Bishop Christopher Saunders, you mentioned in your op-ed piece in the Fairfax Press lifestyle choices, and you seem to have taken exception with that particular description. Are we really talking about a lifestyle choice here for Indigenous people who are living in these communities?
Well, no. I think we're talking about fundamentals for Aboriginal people. What we sometimes don't realise in this wonderful nation of ours is that our Aboriginal brothers and sisters have an affinity with the land and a spiritual connection with the land that we would like to have, but simply the rest of us don't have. And that spiritual affinity they have is part of the essential of their being. So their culture and their connection with land are nothing to do with lifestyle. It's to do with who they are. It's to do with the definition of who they are in this country and who they understand themselves to be. So the talk about it being a lifestyle choice is crazy. It's not something peripheral. It's at the heart of who they are. One of the difficulties we have as Australians is that we have a history of relationships with Aboriginal people that is far outdated and outlived its usefulness. We really haven't grappled with the thought that Aboriginal people have a right to have a say in their future, and that we need to be true and honest and determined in our consultations, that is to say the consultations of governments with Aboriginal people and with institutions with Aboriginal people.
We live in a country, 2015, where things have changed, but we also have a long history of segregation, which was practiced, then assimilation, which was practiced. Indigenous Australians received the vote in 67, so late in our history. So we are talking about a long history of quite serious intervention where the dominant culture was not talking to Indigenous culture, aren't we?
Well, that's true, and I remember just reading recently the minutes of a select committee in 1845 where Bishop Poulding spoke in defence of Aboriginal people, citing the amount of suffering that they were enduring and the treatment by non-Aboriginal people of Aboriginal people. Now, that laid the foundation, those years, those early years of colonisation, laid the foundations of what's gone on ever since. And there have been bright moments, the referendum 1967, and there have been other bright moments too, such as Mabo and Wick and these other legal determinations. Even the outstation movement in recent years, in which we've encouraged Aboriginal people to move back to traditional lands, all of those have been signs that there is a good change on the way. And then all of a sudden now, we seem to have taken a couple of steps backwards, and that's what we've got to stand up against.
There's two things I want to pick up there, if that's okay. Firstly, you mentioned Archbishop Poulding. Now, the first Archbishop of Sydney, the first Bishop, a Benedictine, who came in, noticed that Indigenous people were being severely mistreated. And I've just recently been reading reports of arsenic poisonings, shootings, terrible history, which the missionaries first reacted to and said, we've got to do something about this. And Archbishop Poulding was one of those. And on the one hand, the missions and the church missions were a help. They were safer places in many instances for Indigenous people to live. But even the church experience and the church activity with Indigenous people has been difficult at times, and even that has changed, hasn't it?
Well, it certainly has, because the churches were founded amongst their own members, and their own members who came out here were settlers, and settlers took land from Aboriginal people. And so many of the church parishioners in the early days of the church were people who took land from Aboriginal people and made it their own.
It's complicated.
The membership of our church has really complicated the whole matter of relationships with Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people. And we've seen that in a couple of TV series recently.
When you talk about membership, 74% of Indigenous Australians, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, report themselves as Christian. That is, in fact, a sign that the missions were, in one sense, quite successful because Indigenous people took on Christianity in large numbers.
Well, yes, they did. And I think that for a lot of them, I can speak with surety for the Kimberley, that for a lot of them, the church represented a haven of safety in the midst of massive exploitation by various industries, including the pastoral industry and the pearling industry. The church stood out as being a protector and offered protection to Aboriginal people from the harshness of those days. And I think that was the beginning of some wonderful relationships between church personnel and Aboriginal people. The earliest days, catechisms and scriptures were all in local languages, and there was a working relationship and a loving relationship between missionaries and Aboriginal people. It wasn't always perfect because there were sciences such as anthropology that missionaries didn't understand. Mm. And that gave rise to some difficulties. But there were good moments too. And even today when you speak to the old people, they'll tell you that the greatest gift that the church brought was peace to the land.
Well, depending on what state you were in and how the Aboriginal protector worked within that state, there were periods where Indigenous peoples were collected onto missions, were forced to go to reserves. There were various ways legislatively that our states and our authorities told Indigenous people what they were to do and gave them no choice in. In one sense, it's ironic that in 2015, it's the leader of a church who is now saying it's time to stop doing that sort of stuff. How do you look at the current situation in Western Australia where we're talking about closing remote communities and then put that into the context of the long history that there has been already?
Yes, when you look to the past and to the characters like Mr. Neville, who featured rather prominently in that film, The Rabbit Proof Fence, who was into genetic engineering and into social Darwinianism, those were pretty hard days, and the fact there was an open warfare between the Catholic Church up here in the Kimberley and Mr. Neville over several factors that I won't go into now, but always it was about relationships with Aboriginal people and his treatment of them. But what do we see today is a massive step backwards. We've come to the point of recognising that the greatest assets that the Aboriginal people had from the very beginning was their land and their culture. And they were the first two things that we took away from them. The land deliberately and the culture sometimes deliberately and sometimes indeliberately. But nevertheless, it was taken away, their culture and language. And now we're saying, we have been saying in recent years, this is a time for restitution. Go back to your homelands and live your life as you have. And you're entitled to do that. And we weren't entitled to take that land. Now all of a sudden we're saying, well, you can live on those lands, but you're not going to get any support from us. We'll simply take the funds away and make it impossible for you to live there so that you don't have any fuel for your generator, so you don't have any water to drink. And forcing people again into towns as fringe dwellers. That seems to me be a massive step backwards.
For those outside West Australia who may not be entirely across exactly what's been happening there, you mentioned in your op-ed piece in Fairfax that 40 years ago, Aboriginals were encouraged to move from townships to isolated villages. Now, what was that process for those of us who were not in your state?
Yes, it was called part of the outstation movement. It was tied up with Mabo and it was tied up with various land rights movements. And it was a recognition that Aboriginal people living on the fringes of towns and settlements, where they had been pushed off cattle stations, for instance, when the equal wages came in, and went to live in these remote locations, where they weren't coping. And there was nothing there for them. And they were simply addendums attached to these remote settlements and these towns, and living in pretty hard conditions. And never, ever did we ever catch up with the needs of housing and all the sorts of needs that you have when you live in a town. Now, what happened was that we said, okay, there are these lands that were your traditional lands, and you have a right to hunt on them and to live on them, and we will support you in that in this outstation movement. So the various places, bores were sunk and small generators put in to get the water out of the ground and provide electricity. Houses were built, and people moved back onto their land and away from the terrors and the travesties of living in a township. Mm. And there they lived on their traditional land. Not entirely in the traditional way, but certainly in the oneness with the land that was their own. Now, that is the outstation movement, and it grew and it grew, and to the point now where the government's saying, oh, we really can't afford to keep it going.
It's expensive to do this, in other words.
That's right. It's costing us too much money. But, of course, it's really a false economy. I mean, if you move people off those stations by whichever way you do it, if you starve them of funds so that they come to live in town, they become fringe dwellers, and you create a whole new generation of people whose social dividends are nothing but negative. And therefore, then they become recipients of welfare, and then they are people who need support of in social welfare services and hospitals and all sorts of things. And there'll be increases in drinking and violence. And we know this. This is not fabrication. We know this from experience. So it seems to me we're solving one problem, and in West Australia we're saving ourselves $90 million and we're laying the foundation for multi-million dollars of problems in the future. And that is why we're objecting to this, the government's attitude at the moment of saying that they wish to close these Aboriginal communities or to see them diminish in size.
You tell Bishop Saunders of clergy stress for those who have worked in these communities and who go back and forth. I've spoken to clergy who worked in the town camps in Alice, for example.
Mm.
And you tell a story in your op-ed piece of a minister trying to talk to his fellow ministers of his experience, but just simply bursting into tears and having to be carried, you know, escorted out, basically, yeah. and put back together again. What sort of experiences are these clergy having, and what are they seeing in the camps that brings them to that point?
Well, that particular place was in another state other than Western Australia, that clergyman was working. And it was one of these, what are erroneously called missions, but they're government settlements, that has grown topsy-turvy over the years, and I won't mention his name, but it's notorious in the particular state which it exists. And the priest there, who was there at one stage with a couple of sisters working there, and then when the sisters left, was working there on his own, was in a position where continually, time and time again, he's consoling families who have lost children by means of suicide, by means of car accidents, by means of all sorts of dangerous behaviour.
Risk-taking, in other words.
That's right, correct. And that sort of lifestyle that has covered those communities with this pall of suffering is his life, and there's not a lot of relief from it. And I don't think in his instance, and there are other people like him, I don't think that in his instance that he's received the sort of support that he's needed. Unless you live in these communities, as I have and many other people have, you don't really understand the dynamics of what's at work. And you don't understand the toll that it can take on people. I remember in one place where I was assigned, we had a suicide contagion of six young people, one after another. And I remember one of the elders, a lady, saying to me, Father, we can't take much more of this. This is, we're drained. We're just drained. There's nothing left in us. Because so many families are interrelated, so they're just going to funeral after funeral and trying to deal with this. And so the clergymen too, if they're close to their people, will be suffering in the same sort of way. And that's just one of the realities that you, there's the cross that you bear when you decide you work in these places.
Again, Bishop Saunders, for the punter who may not know exactly how Broome works, as a bishop, how do you get your information? I'm conscious in one sense you're a European, I'm a European, we're talking about Indigenous people, but how do you get your information and how do you find out the situation of Indigenous Catholics and Indigenous people in your area?
Well, the church has a very good relationship with people in this neck of the woods, and I've been up here next year's 40 years. I've been up here 40 years this year, and after all those years, you spend time with people and you get to know them, and you can't do anything unless you build relationships, and in those relationships that you establish, people trust you and tell you things, and when I ask questions, they're honest and good enough to give me answers.
So direct, you're saying, you're talking to the families, you're talking to the people in these communities, and they're telling you directly, as the bishop, this is what their experience is.
And 98% of what I wrote in that paper is my own personal experience, and that's where it came from.
Can I ask you, Bishop Christopher Saunders, how committed do you feel the bishops are with you in doing this? Because that is another way the church can assist. We've got, 25, 26 dioceses around the country. Mm. That's a lot of push. And I saw a lot of action, for example, around the Don't Mess With Marriage project, where interfaith things were signed, letters were sent around the country. But I don't see quite the same activity on this one. How committed do you think your fellow bishops are?
I have no doubt about their commitment. I guess it's a question of energy. Where do you put it? There are some very big social questions that are facing us as a nation today, and the Aboriginals is one of them. For me, of course, it's paramount, and for many other bishops it is also paramount. But for many of them, they have a multiplicity of challenges and a multiplicity of things that they need to take on. You can't put all your energy into one area when there's a demand for you to put it into many areas. I have no hesitation in believing that I know from talking to bishops that they're extremely supportive, and they have a point of view that is absolutely supportive of Aboriginal people, and they stand in solidarity with Aboriginal people. And I guess that they have to wrestle with the issue of how much energy that they can put into
each issue.
In a sense, I guess I'm probably pushing the Aboriginal issue to the detriment of some of the others, you know, but that's my basket.
Well, can I ask Christopher Saunders, the human being as well as the bishop, of course, how important is this to you? How central is it to the church's work when you see something like the communities around you called a lifestyle choice to cut through and to change views and to get conversation going? How important is it?
Well, for me, I can't see of anything more important than the benefit and the well-being of Indigenous people who are in my bailiwick and those who are in other areas in Australia. For me, that's of paramount importance. It's my life work, and their welfare and their well-being is what I have committed myself to for the last 40 years, and probably a few years to go, I hope.
How much change have you seen? How full of courage or hope are you that things are getting better?
Oh, listen, I'm always beating the drum of desperation. I remember as a young fellow coming here and being absolutely appalled at the infant mortality rate. I buried babies, and not one, but a number in a year, and just wondering, my God, what sort of country is this? This is the infant mortality rate in third world countries. Now, that has improved dramatically, and so have opportunities in education, and so has the level of education amongst Indigenous people. Indigenous people now have a voice. Their leaders are standing up and have been standing up for some years, but there are more and more of them, and they have a greater courage and a greater sense of direction. So I'm very positive. I mean, it won't stop me from beating the drum of desperation, but I also believe that we are moving along the highway. It's a bit like driving one of these Kimberley roads. You know, you look ahead and all you see is the road disappear into infinity.
But you do get somewhere eventually.
Well, yeah, and you look in the rear vision mirror and you see the same thing. So we have been somewhere. We are moving, and that moving is good. And it's important that we recognise that too, because that also does give us hope and does give us an understanding that there is a better world that we are capable of developing and growing.
Bishop Christopher Saunders, Catholic Bishop of Broome, thank you very much for being part of Sunday Nights.
Thank you very much, Noel.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio.